Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, creation speaker and software engineer.
Fred, I got my brand new Answers magazine in the mail.
Oh, I did too. It's a great addition. But you know what, Bob? I want to talk about a news story first.
Oh, before this?
Yeah. Let's. All right. Can we do that?
Yeah.
I think it's kind of funny, actually. It's an atheist who was wearing a certain headgear and wanted the right to have that on his driver's license.
That's a good one, Fred. That's not from the U.S., right?
No, this is an Austrian citizen who, again, he's an atheist.
Yeah.
And
well, here from the BBC in London, this guy, his name is Nico Alm. He saw in the news that Muslims could have their driver's license photo taken with religious headgear. And he thinks, hey, I'm an atheist. And I belong to some crazy atheist cult. So he went in to the motor vehicle department with a spaghetti strainer on his head.
A spaghetti strainer, that's right.
Yeah, and Fred, there are photos of him online with a spaghetti strainer. He says his religion is Pastafarianism. So he worships the Church of, what is it called?
Is it the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster?
Yeah, it is.
They like to use that as kind of a way of making fun of,
yeah,
you know,
for decades.
Real believers.
Right. There's no evidence for the Flying Spaghetti Monster, so that's who they believe in.
I like that they had a medical interview that established that he was mentally fit to drive.
they did do that. They said he was mentally fit. My great-grandfather was born in Italy. On my mom's side, they're all Italians. And we call this a scuta macaroon.
A scuta macadoon?
Yeah.
What, the head?
No, not the headgear. Not wearing it on your head. But you could. You could say that his brains are like a scuta macadoon. It's a spaghetti strainer, a pasta strainer. It strains the macaroni noodles.
Huh.
It drains the water out of them. So he wears a scuta macadoon on his head. And, Fred, it is funny that we've said on this show how many times that atheism is inherently contradictory. That's what it is.
It absolutely is. I mean, I remember a guestbook comment on my Evolution Fairy Tale website that,
yeah,
this guy said that the only universal truth out there is that there are no absolutes.
Right.
The only universal truth out there is that there's no absolutes.
Right. So there are no universal truths other than this one universal truth. This article, this short article from the BBC, it says the same thing, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. He says that the only dogma allowed in the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster is the rejection of dogma.
It is so funny, Fred. Atheism is self-refuting in so many ways, and every time you turn around, in this case, their belief system is internally, on the surface, contradictory.
Oh, constantly.
In a single sentence, they contradict themselves. Like for me, I might contradict myself, but it might take 3 or 4 minutes of listening before I get around to forgetting what I said. But these guys do it in a single sentence. Our only dogma is that there is no dogma. Atheism is the increasing exaltation of ignorance.
So do you think the headline of this meant to have the pun that this Austrian driver's religious headgear strains credulity?
Yeah, not only that, the reporter is funny because the reporter says that the thought came into his noodle that he would take his photo with a spaghetti strainer on his head. So he's a Pastafarianism. That's his religion, Pastafarianism. All right, so Fred, you brought up a news story. Could I bring up a Starbucks encounter?
Sure.
All right. I'm in line at Starbucks, and this guy comes up to me. This is yesterday. We've talked briefly once or twice in the past. He knows I do a show. And he came up, and he said, so, Bob, what's on the show today? So I said, well, tomorrow we'll have Fred Williams' Real Science Friday, Creation Evolution. And he launches. He's a big frame guy, bold, aggressive, a likable guy. And he says, do you know that in Genesis, the word day does not appear? It's the Hebrew word for age. He said it's a word for age, and he went on, Fred, without taking a breath for 2 or 3 minutes. It's just too much.
And you're just kind of letting him go for a while.
Just let him go. Because
you know that it's so not true.
And I said, well, the Hebrew word for day is yom. We would spell it Y-O-M. That's their normal word for day. That's the only word for day in Genesis there. And it says the evening and the morning was the first day, the second day, the third day. So everything you've just said is completely wrong. It's not true. And so then I quoted a Hebrew professor from Oxford who said, at all the world-class universities, all the professors of Hebrew and Old Testament agree with that, that that's what the author of Genesis meant. So he said, well, the Hebrew changed 500 years before Christ. The Hebrew language changed. He has proof of that, you know. So I asked him, I said, well, did carbon 14 change at the same time? And he said, no. So I thought, well, we got something to work with here. And I said, do you realize that they find carbon 14 everywhere they've looked, everywhere where it shouldn't be? So it's not an anomaly. They find it in amber, coal, gas, oil, dinosaur fossils. They find it in diamonds.
So you set that trap, and he put his foot into the trap. So what happened
next? It was really good. It was a really good conclusion. I'd say, Fred, within 4 or 5 minutes, he was thinking, because he had heard carbon-14 and dinosaur fossils. He had heard about that. And then he wanted to know, in diamonds, that's the hardest natural substance on Earth. It couldn't work its way in there. So it couldn't be contamination. So within 5 minutes, he was thinking that, you know, the Earth very well may only be thousands of years old, and maybe Genesis is right.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and I asked him, do you believe in God? He said, absolutely, and so hopefully we're going to talk again when we run into each other at Starbucks.
Well, that's really neat. And, you know, we were just having a conversation on the Evolution Fairytale Forum about Genesis and the day Yom, and, you know, it's used with, just like you said, it's used with an ordinal, a number. Right.
Second day, third day, fourth day.
It's used with qualifiers evening and morning. If the day in Hebrew is just like the English word for day, they're virtually identical.
Right.
You know what it means by the context.
Right.
Bob, if I tell you I'm going on vacation on the 27th and then I end up going on the 28th, you're going to think I either made a mistake or I'm really bad at grammar.
Right.
So if God really meant eras of time, frankly, God's bad at grammar because it's so clear in Genesis 1. It's a day. There's no way you can get around it.
Right. And the sun, what, the earth survived for millions of years without the sun, which was made on the fourth day.
And if I say, Bob, I'll pick you up tomorrow morning, and then I never show up, you're going to be mad at me.
Right.
And then if I say, well, no, Bob, I meant an era of time, I might pick you up a week from tomorrow morning.
Right, right. We would know. So, Fred, what did you think of this issue of Answers July through September 2011?
Oh, it was tremendous. It really was.
Yeah.
One of the articles, one of the first ones in the magazine was on the sharks.
Oh, yeah, sharks.
And I can kind of relate because it's you know, the sharks have a GPS system, and I work for Trimble, and we design systems that use GPS to track vehicles.
Yeah, and very advanced applications that are used around the world. That's a neat thing you do with your engineering skills.
So I'm wondering, how many satellites does the shark use to
tie in? So these sharks, now this shark GPS is sort of really wildly cool. And before we describe it, Fred, for those who are listening, there are Christians, creationists, and there are also unbelievers and atheists. And so when we talk about a story like this with the extraordinary abilities of living creatures, there are two things that people could consider. One is we're bragging about God. We're bragging about what a brilliant designer he is, engineer, architect. He's awesome. Secondly, we realize from their perspective, they think this happened naturally. So we're appealing to their mental faculties and their intuition to think through, could this possibly evolve by random changes and natural selection? So what is it that these sharks can do? They sort of have some kind of GPS?
Yeah, and they mention here that the sharks can locate food some 30 miles away in precise location, and they swim towards it not in the daylight but when it's dark. So it's not like they're using sight to see where they're going. Now, there is a possibility that smell plays a part of it. It could be the magnetic field. They haven't solved that yet.
This is in the Journal of Animal Ecology. scientists have figured out that they're confirming that these fish can navigate to a destination in total darkness beneath the waves. And so they're saying, we're trying to figure out how this happens, but one possibility for sure is that they can sense the Earth's magnetic field. There are a lot of animals that God gave that ability to.
Yeah, that's right. Now, yeah, so somehow it has a map in its mind, an intelligence. It has information. Where did that information come from that allows him to be able to track things like this that are 30 miles away? They can't see this stuff.
Right. And say migrating birds leave from North America and they fly to Hawaii. They're not following scent.
That's right.
They're not smelling the palm trees. They are navigating the globe, a huge chunk of the globe, with the God-given instinct to be able to sense in a global perspective where they are and where they need to head. So it's not surprising that sharks also have this ability.
It's not surprising.
No.
I mean, what you're saying reminds me of the golden plover. We've probably mentioned that on the show before, where they migrate from Alaska to Hawaii. There's not any islands in between where they can land and rest, and so scientists were baffled how they could make it all the way to Hawaii. And how do they make it there, Bob? There's a mechanism they use.
Fred, they do it because they're aerodynamic engineers. They understand that they have to fly in the shape of a V. I don't think they really understand it. God put the instinct in them. They fly in the shape of a V, of the form of a V, to reduce the drag on the animals that have another bird right in front of them in a beautiful pattern. And it's the bird at the point of the V that takes the brunt of the drag, the wind resistance.
And they take turns in the front, and the stronger birds are the ones that tend to stay in the front of the V. As you go towards the back of the V, you don't have to have as much strength. So they use a somewhat of a symbiotic relationship, you know, to support each other.
Right.
You know, without that V-shaped pattern, they'd plop in the ocean 500 miles short of Hawaii. Flying in a V, they'd go 500 miles past. So it's not just the GPS navigation to know where to go in Hawaii. It's also how to get there. Where does that information come from? The parent birds have long taken off. They didn't sit there and show them a map and show them, hey, this is how you fly. You fly in a V.
They didn't tell them where they have to meet in order for their species to survive. And Fred, it would be like we humans, we have more brain capacity than birds do. What if for your children to survive, they had to walk to a little village somewhere in Idaho, and nobody told them that they had to go anywhere, let alone to this little town in Idaho, and they had to walk there. There were no maps, and they just all had to go there, and then only by doing that would the species survive. It's just... It's not plausible that that could evolve in any kind of stepwise fashion, especially then when you're going over the ocean thousands of miles.
That's right. And, you know, there's another article that maybe this dovetails into that about animal instincts. So it reminds me of one of the ones they mentioned in here, the sea turtle. You know, they hatch on the shore of the ocean. Where do they go? Do they head to the nearest Starbucks and argue creation?
Yeah, the mother turtle lays the eggs in the sand, and if the sea turtles headed toward land or just hung out on the beach, instead of making a beeline for the water, they'd be picked off by predators. They would not survive as these baby turtle hatchlings.
That's right. And what do they do instead? They make a beeline for the water.
Yeah, they do. And like the kangaroo rat, Fred, in the same article on instincts, that whenever it hears the sound of a rattlesnake, it automatically jumps. It has this escape jump that it does that's amazing. And it does that the first time it ever hears a rattler.
Well, I did the same thing the first time I heard one, Bob.
Yeah, but you had seen on TV. You knew it was coming. But normally you hear a rattle and, you know, it's a curiosity. But that creature instinctively knows to jump. Fred, didn't they do an experiment, scientists, with the heart rate of turkeys?
Yeah, they did.
Describe that.
It was really interesting. Apparently, they showed the shape of a predator bird. Predator birds have a shorter neck, almost universally.
A short neck, and then their wingspan, and then a tail, right?
Yeah, that's right. Whereas birds that are docile, you know, like a geese, they've got the longer neck.
A long neck, then their wings, and then their their tail side.
Yeah, that's right.
So predators have a different shape,
different
shadow.
Shape. And so this shadow, when they see the shadow of a predator-like bird, their heart rate jumps dramatically.
Whoa. That is so interesting. And scientists have been trying to figure out instincts for decades, for centuries, probably for millennium. Where do instincts come from? And if you think about it, we now know even more than they did centuries ago. We know that every organism begins as a single cell from mom and dad. So whether it's a baby human or something from the animal kingdom, the idea that this information goes along with that single cell, like we now know, we've talked about it on this show at Harvard and elsewhere, they figured out that babies have a rudimentary understanding of mathematics, physics, the laws of physics and gravity, and right and wrong in ethics. Babies.
Right and wrong. Well, where did that come from?
Yeah, and right and wrong, these are not physical concepts. These are the laws of logic, reason, grammar, and morality. They're not physical. How do you encode something that's not physical, and how do you get it passed on in the single cell that's so tiny we can't see it? This is all evidence for God.
Oh, yeah. Information is a huge nail in the coffin for the evolutionary worldview. If you imagine a computer with the power supply and all the hardware parts and this and that, will a computer operate? Can you do a Google search on your computer with just raw material and energy? Because that's what atheists say is basically all there is, right? Energy and matter.
Right.
Wait a minute. There's something missing from this equation.
Right. Information.
That's right.
Fred, this article on instincts, they talk about spiders. And spiders, we've talked recently about the different kinds of glue that spiders use and the smart glue and the silk of the spider web. And they add to that that not only do spiders spin various kinds of silk, some sticky and some not, they perform impressive feats, but they also spin parachute threads, which are a different kind of silk, and they catch the wind. Spiders travel many miles by air. Now, that's just too much.
Travels many miles by air.
That's scary. Yesterday, I helped a retiring pastor, Fred, move his library, and he donated some of it to Denver Bible Church, which was a great honor. It's a really super library.
Cool.
At his house, I was looking at a bush, and there's a perfect spider web. And I was trying to trick the spider into thinking there was a bug in the web. And I tricked him for about a tenth of a second by vibrating a little twig. After a tenth of a second, he knew it was a scam. He was refusing to go check it out.
Did he form a parachute and come after you? You're always running into spider webs. You know, I'm tall. I'm always running into spider web.
Yeah.
I'm always wondering, where is that guy? I know that he's probably in that spider web somewhere.
Right. He's on me. So, Fred, it's for reasons like this that many people, regardless of all the propaganda, they see through it and they realize that Darwinism can't tell the story of life on Earth. It's not able to do so. So there's an article in here about a recent study of about 1,000 U.S. high school biology teachers from the public schools. And boy, this is an interesting article. Did you take note of that?
So yes, Bob, it says that this study showed that more than 1 in 10 biology teachers believe creation should be taught.
That is interesting in the public schools, that more than 1 in 10. It turns out that 13% of public school teachers admitted in this massive survey of biology teachers that they spend 1 hour or more teaching creation, that they teach intelligent design or creation in the public schools. And this is infuriating Eugenie Scott and all the atheists. They're really angry about this.
Oh, absolutely. And what I found even more interesting is that 60% of them are reluctant to teach evolution. Isn't that
cool? That is
That says a lot right there, and we're making headways because they know that they say something that's, frankly, the things we talk about on this show shows how silly evolution is.
Yeah.
And they've got to know that. You know, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen.
God's invisible attributes are clearly seen from the things that are made. Fred, you shouldn't quote the Bible without us doing a warning. You know, there are liberals listening who are intolerant. The FCC's out there. We got to do warnings if we're going to quote the Bible, including Romans chapter 1. But yeah, I like this one. Nearly 60% of biology teachers are reluctant to endorse evolution. And what they do is they tell the students, well, you got to know it for the test. Or they say, make up your own mind. But they will not endorse evolution, 60%. And within that 60%, nearly 60, is the 13% who actually teach some form of creation. So, wow, this is really interesting. Now, here's what I think is going to happen, Fred. In this article that was in Science Magazine, they called for better trained teachers. And that's scary because that's code. Mm-hmm. What they really mean is they want to extend the purge downward from the professors and editors like at the Smithsonian that we've talked about who have been fired, who have had their careers ruined. They want that purge to be extended downward to high school teachers.
That's right. And you know, something else that I'd like to say about this, that's kind of hidden in all this, because I had a young student, one of the talks I gave, and she said she went to public schools. I asked the question, how much do you hear about evolution? And she goes, well, I went to a private Christian school and then later to a public school, and I didn't hear that much more about evolution. Hmm. Well, at the time, I didn't have the best answer to reply to that, and I did after I left the meeting. And it occurred to me, yeah, she's probably going to a school like they talk about here, where their biology teacher is reluctant to talk about evolution. However, what we're missing is there is always going to be a constant inundation of millions of years.
Right.
That's going to be there. You know
old
it
Earth,
for sure.
Old Earth.
The billions of years of the age
of the Earth. Once you buy old Earth, you end up rejecting Adam and Eve, often the global flood, virtually always.
That's right.
The Tower of Babel, even the fall of Jericho, and eventually Jonah. And on and on and on.
And millions and billions is such an abstract thing that people don't take the time to get their mind around it. They just right. accept it.
Yeah.
Whereas evolution is so silly that it's tough for teachers to get away with teaching mm-hmm. it and sound yeah. incredible.
Yeah. Jerry Bergman wrote that volume, The Slaughter of the Dissidents. You've seen in the news how California now is mandating, starting with kindergarten teachers on up, that they present homosexual history in a positive light, how homosexuals have played an important part in human history, apparently. And that purge, it will deepen and it will broaden. Because if you are a Christian, if you believe that God made us male and female in his image, you will be rejected from increasingly broad areas of the public sector.
That's right. And I wish more and more people would realize the agenda that's going on with the public schools.
Mm-hmm. So meanwhile, while in the public schools, they're horrified. Eugenie Scott, National Center for Science Education, she's an anti-creationist. I debated her. It was a lot of fun. We sell the DVD.
And I'm sure she doesn't.
Yeah, she doesn't. And you could hear the debate on one of the old Real Science Friday shows. Just go to realsciencefriday.com and search for Eugenie, and you'll find it. So, Fred, they're all upset, even though the public schools are the bastion of Darwinism. Well, then you go to Christian colleges, and you find a different story still. This is one reason I really appreciate Ken Ham and his Answers in Genesis ministry, the Creation Museum there in Kentucky on the Ohio border, and this Answers magazine. He really brings to light crucially important issues. And they did a survey. They talked to a lot of professors and officials at Christian colleges and universities, and they found out some information that was not good.
Yeah, it's real interesting and frankly not surprising. For example, on the survey, Bob, they noticed that 52% of the presidents of these universities claim to be a young earth creationist. 51% of the vice presidents, et cetera. What does your institution teach about evolution? We show that evolution to be false. Only 19% of the presidents admitted to that.
Only 19%. And Fred, they talk to a lot of, this is a good study. They talked to 312 administrators and professors, professors from the right departments, the science department and the Old Testament departments. This was from 200 different colleges, Christian colleges. And you know, quite often the bigger the college that is considered to be conservative or Christian, the more likely that they're going to teach in Old Earth, quite often. So some of the numbers that look good, you know, that there's about half of the presidents that believe the Earth is young. A lot of them are at the smaller colleges, unfortunately. But Fred, how about this? Views on Old Testament history, only 42% consider themselves a young Earth Christian. This is the leaders at our Christian colleges. Almost 40% believe that the flood was local, not a global flood.
And it's interesting, as you get into the departments and away from the leadership, it gets worse. Mm-hmm. For example, the number of faculty in the religion departments that's claimed to be young Earth creationists is 15%.
Whoa, that is really a problem. And that's like in the Old Testament departments, for example. The science professors, a higher percentage of the science professors were young Earth.
57%.
As compared to, say, the Old Testament professors.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that is really encouraging, actually, because it shows that the Christians who are actually looking at the evidence are coming out with a better understanding. It reminds me of Gallup surveys of scientists, whether they're biologists, astronomers, or mathematicians. Overwhelmingly, they're Darwinist. But the biggest percentage of scientists who are not Darwinist are from the mathematicians. And math is the most pure science. We had a speaker at Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship last Friday night. He did a tremendous job, James Nickel. And math is the pure science. You don't get away with garbage in math. So I'm encouraged that the science teachers in Christian colleges are the ones who most recognize the Earth is young and evolution is false. And the mathematicians in the secular realm are the ones who most realize that Darwinism is false.
So I wonder about these people in the religious departments, if they're relying on secular science, they're not really looking into it.
Right.
Because if they looked at just the words of the Bible, we talked about it earlier in the show, like the day Yom, there's mm-hmm. no way you can get evolution and millions of years into the Bible. It's not possible.
Right. You have to be willing to reject what Moses intended by his writing. For example, the global flood. Old Earth Christians reject a global flood. Those two go together.
And why is that?
It's because all the strata on the Earth that supposedly are the evidence of billions of years were laid down by a global flood. So if there's a global flood, you don't need billions of years.
From the same study, again, the leadership showed quite a strong belief in a global flood. Interestingly, both the science and the religious department had a belief in a global flood of about 57% believed in a global flood. But a lot of them will still believe in an old Earth. So I don't know if they're holding to the gap theory or what.
Oh,
but they're not thinking through the issues.
You know what, Fred? I think those numbers, I pondered that also. And they got to be coming from the religious department, not the science department, because the science department would recognize that these are incompatible. That's very interesting. Fred, we're out of time. Where'd that show go?
I know. We'll have to do another one because we got a lot more in this magazine to cover.
All right. God bless you, Fred Williams. Thanks, those of you out there, for tuning in. Our website is kgov.com. We need your help to stay on the air, so please check out our store or even donate. God bless you.